lead us.
I just recognised how difficult it is to to talk whilst chewing his jelly bean. Yeah. It's like glue. It's yours stuck together. Right. Is that yours?
Yeah.
Why do you carry that around?
So my uni work in there, so I highlight my, I've got my load of academic journals in there. I won't bore you with it.
Do you use the word academic journals rather than books because it sounds more intelligent?
No, I use academic journals because they're called academic journals.
Welcome back to another edition of After the Whistle, and I'm delighted to say that Leon is back from his many holidays around the world with a World Cup medal.
I have got a World Cup medal. It's great to be back. It's not actually a World Cup medal. It's a medal I got from the World Cup. Actually, it's a World Cup medal.
You stole it. did you steal it? Oh, wow.
Yeah.
It was you showed me a picture.
It's awesome. I'm actually going to bring it in. It probably didn't work as well on a podcast.
But just explain where you got it. I don't get it. Like you, because you weren't participating in a World Cup.
Yes, I was.
How?
I was part of the judiciary team. We have a very important job to do. Did you watch the World Cup?
I did watch the World Cup, yeah.
And did you
watch it? Because I remember talking about it quite a few times.
I did watch it. I was out there participating in it with a great team of judiciary officers. And it was great. It was really good. We got presented with a medal for our contributions. It's quite emotional. Nearly shed a tear.
Your contributions to what? To the judiciary? Oh, I can never
say
that.
I can't say it.
Well, anyway, right. We're not here to talk about your World Cup medal. Well, you've always gone about your World Cup moment, so maybe
that's
that was
not it. By the way, that's not it. But it was a moment.
Still working and building towards it. So, mate, we are obviously here. You're back, and we're going to have a little chat today. And we've spoken to you in the past. And,
yeah. So today, I think today we're going to flip it over, and we're going to talk about a little bit about you and. Open it up about your history, your CV, your biog, things that are interesting, what makes you tick. Because people who know you from the outside, or people who see you from a public perception may have an idea of what they think you're like, especially when you've got this nickname that you've given yourself, the Mad Dog nickname. Someone did nickname Mad Dog. I can never get my head around that.
Do you remember when Jim Naylor came to Leicester from, I can't remember where it was, and his nickname was something rubbish, but when he came to Leicester, he changed it to the Axe or something.
Ace Naylor. What do the lads call you? Oh, the lads call me Ace. All right.
As if they call him that.
No one called him Ace. But we do now.
Yeah, we do. You're
so that worked for you as well, Mad Dog. Anyway.
Yeah.
All right, let's get back to you. So I'm going to read through your stats. It actually surprised me when I was reading through them. You've actually achieved quite a bit. I didn't realise that. So you were born in 1975 in...
Yeah. Bracknell. I'm still younger than you.
Yeah, 1935. So you played at Bracknell Minis. You went to Oakham School.
Yeah.
Following through, then to Montfort University.
Or Eagle House School first, but.
Eagle House School Bracknell, before, yeah, okay. Yeah. Then you went, so you joined Leicester Tigers. I remember we trialled against each other and the youth team. We've talked about that before, so we won't go into detail about that. But you went to.
Was that when I dominated you?
It was when you, yeah, definitely. You definitely dominated. Me and I stayed on.
It's gone down a totally different track.
Does that sound right?
Yeah.
You definitely dominated me. I've said it twice, that makes it even worse.
Why did you say it again? So Lisa's going to be
anyway,
so upset.
Anyway, so you went to De Montfort University. You started at De Montfort University. I remember at the time when we were playing under, there was a few of you, it was you, Geordie Murphy, a few of the guys were trying to combine playing rugby with study.
Yeah.
And I wasn't one of those. I was just all in effectively with rugby. And it was quite difficult, if you remember, trying to do both.
Yeah.
Both things. We'll come on to that in a minute when we talked about De Montfort, because the irony of you getting an honorary doctorate still pains me.
Well, chat about now. I mean, it was. You said it was naive to think, for me anyway, to think that I could do them both together and actually do a degree. I really wanted, I genuinely want to do a degree, but I didn't want to do it.
Were you at school, were you an academic?
No, not at all. I struggled. I did it because there were things that I enjoyed at school, like history, you know, design, art. They didn't have PE as an option, but English, maths, all those things, you know, didn't necessarily come naturally. But so when I got my A-levels, I did generally want to do a degree in archaeology.
What were your A-levels in?
Well, the ones I got, geography and design. The one I didn't get was biology. Got a U in biology.
So you actually passed the A-levels. You passed your A-levels.
Yeah,
so you could actually qualify. A-levels. So, and what was the dream then? Because your dream wasn't then wanting to play professional rugby, because it wasn't a career choice, was it? So what was you're going to university to do what?
Well, so I wanted to go to the army. So I was chatting with I can't remember what they're called, but like the army liaison officer about joining the Marines. So to get sponsorship through university to join the Marines. So I think you had to do, if you did a degree, so whatever, it took 3 years, you get sponsored by the army, they'd pay for it. And then when you came out the other side, you'd go do 3 to 5 years, I think. So go through officer training and do all that. And I was genuinely excited about that. I was in the CCF as a kid, the cadet force. Loved that. Loved pretending to run around and, you know, play army, play soldiers, all that sort of stuff. And I suppose that's where, you know, was starting my interest in First World War and Second World War. So when I left school, the summer I was leaving school and having all those conversations and getting ready, rugby turned professional. So instead of going down a sponsored route through university, the Tigers, Leicester Tigers, ended up putting me into De Montfort University to study business, which, you know, would be really useful now, quite frankly, if I had stuck at it and got that degree. But I was just crap at it. It didn't interest me, so I had no desire or passion to want to go to the lectures every day. I'm not great. I don't receive information well if I'm just spoken at and talked to. I can't retain it.
What was the point of it? What was the point of them sending, you probably don't remember, what was the point of them sending to university? Was it to make sure that you, because there wasn't an academy system in place, was there?
There was 2 points. So I think my parents were, you know, rightly focused on me getting some more qualifications, because rugby had just turned, it was like literally that summer, June 96, turned fully professional. I think it was starting in 95, wasn't it, during that World Cup? But the first full contracts were given in that summer.
But you wouldn't have got one of those. You wouldn't have been given a contract then, would you?
I was not on leaving school. 3 months after leaving school, we had a game against Borough Muir.
Which you made your debut.
Yeah, debut at Leicester. You know, so I was 18 and whatever, having watched all my heroes like Dean Richards, Rory Underwood. So I grew up watching the Tigers, sat in the stands, you know, in the Crumbie. And all of a sudden at 18, I got to run out at Welford Road with all, you know, with all my schoolboy heroes. And, you know, 2 months later, got offered to come down the office with Pete Wheeler, you know, former Lions, England and Tigers player himself, who was then chief exec or CEO or whatever. And my dad gave me a list of sort of things to go in and make sure I got in the contract, you know. So dad thought it was a good idea for me to go in. And
so was there rugby, just going back up to you, on your dad, is there rugby in the family? Were you the first person to, because you're an only child, we just laugh and joke about that quite a lot, about you and your selfish tendencies sometimes. Is there anyone in your family play rugby, or were you the first?
No. So I'm an only child. Dad was sporty, but he had a career as a businessman. So, you know, did a apprenticeship engineering, I think, and then went on to become director of a cement engineering company. So there was no sport. I think he was maybe county, he did county javelin when he was a kid, but other than that, no.
So he was keen to see that you were getting the right contract, understanding your balance and the education with the career turning professional for the first time.
Yeah, so his background was, so he understood, you know, he dealt with £1 million contracts in his job, so signing them off, dealing with all that sort of stuff. So he thought it'd be really useful for me to have that background and go in and, you know, and have the confidence and, you know, ability to be able to deal with that stuff myself. And so I went in with a list of demands, or not demands, but, you know, stuff that I wanted
yourself,
to get signed off.
18 years old. Yeah. Wow.
And I was not a confident kid. Like, I was a very shy kid, really, apart from when I was on the rugby field or surrounded by mates. So I went in, met Pete Wheeler, this legend, and, you know, list of stuff to come out with. And when I came out of the meeting, I was, you know, I was over the moon. I was chuffed. I hadn't actually got a single thing that I wanted.
You don't think about that, do you? You think about, you want to play, you want to wear the shirt.
Yeah. I'd been given a contract to play rugby for Leicester Tigers, having played my first game as an 18-year-old with Dean Richards, Rory Underwood, Martin
Johnson.
That was a
record. That you were the youngest player. Was that the one with the game?
At the time. So summer 96. It was awesome. You know, but there's a very quick realization that as that year went on and I tried to do a degree in business, that I couldn't do both, like, because I wasn't passionate about doing a business degree.
So it wasn't about studying and developing, it was about the actual topic. If it was about history of World War One, World War Two, a degree in that and playing rugby, do you think you'd probably be more better suited?
I think probably at that time, I think rugby was the big enough distraction, and actually university life was a big distraction. So I ended up doing everything really badly. So I didn't really go to university lessons. I didn't really commit to rugby, although I loved it. I was at all the training sessions, but, you know, I was getting distracted by uni life and just drinking and having mates. And
I remember watching very jealous. And it was going out, living the dream.
And it was great fun. It was great fun. And now, you obviously came from a different background. You had a totally different approach. You were singularly focused. You know, I wasn't. I'd come from a public school. Suddenly the world was my oyster, you know. Went from having tons of rules and laws and being told what to do to all of a sudden having nothing. And I could do what I wanted, which I did. And that was, you know, sadly drinking and staying out late most of the time. And after a year, I looked back and just thought, like, I can't continue in the same vein. So I had to make a decision. And ultimately, at the end of that first year, I cut my full-time degree, which was the right thing to do, and I'm glad I did. I did try to pursue it part-time because I recognised it would be beneficial in the long run, but and had more of a focus on my rugby, and that, you know, that made a huge difference because all of a sudden at the end of that 97-98 season, I was I'd had a great year, but I went on my first England tour, or called up into England A's, and then at the end of that year went on first England tour, tour of doom.
So it happened quickly. You went from making your debut in, and you were living with Jordan Murphy.
Yeah,
that must have helped.
Now head coach of the Tigers, isn't he?
That must have helped your social. So I'm trying to get that balance right, because he also was at university as well, wasn't he, at De Montfort, trying to balance the two. And I think he did the same as you and just focused on the sport as well.
Yeah, well, so we didn't live together to start with, but so I was with a load of students in my first year, and that was why it all went Pete Tong, because I was trying to live the same life as they were whilst be a professional sportsman.
You say Pete Tong, if I suppose now, at the time, if you hadn't have gone on to achieve what you achieved, you could have said, do you know what, that's the reason why, that could be one of the reasons why I didn't achieve. But looking back now, and at your CV, what you have achieved, did it go Pete Tong, or did it give you the balance, the, you weren't so focused on it?
Yeah, well, I think that, so in hindsight, that year, I would definitely describe it as going Pete Tong, because I remember turning up to my first appraisal with Dean Richards, it was the end of that summer, and I actually got a phone call, one of my housemates got a phone call, and it said, you know, he came knocking on my door. I think it was like 8, 9 in the morning, something like that. Lewis, I've got Dean Richards on the phone, who was the then coach of the club, having just retired 2 years before from playing. He says, you're supposed to be in an appraisal at the club. And I woke up, I was like, so having gone out the night before with my student mates and, you know.
That's the alarm call you want.
Gone for a curry. Realised I'd left my car in town. So the only car available was my then student housemates, who had one leg. So the pedals on his car were switched over, so the accelerator was on the opposite side of the brake, and vice versa, the brake was on the opposite. So his was the only car I could use. So I got in the car, had to try and figure out how to drive a car with the pedals wrong way round to training. Got to training 45-50 minutes late, and you know it's like working in a team environment, you have to be there 5 minutes before you start, don't you? And then knocked on the door, walked in, I was told immediately to get out. As an 18-19-year-old kid, I was pretty nervous. There was Joel Stransky, John Wells, and Dean Richards. And after about 10 minutes sitting outside, they then said, right, come back in. Went back in, and they, you know, proceeded to give me the mother of all grillings. And at one point, Joel, and, you know, this had never happened now. And when I think back, I think, you know, it was probably wrong that it happened, but he was trying to make a point. You know, he asked me to take my top off. And for the reason of, you know, he was saying that I clearly didn't possess a professional physique because I was out drinking and partying as I had.
So you stood there in front of Dean Richards, George Francis, John Wells. You had to strip off to the waist so they could...
Strip off to the waist sounds weird. I just took my top off and there was no stripping involved.
So you stripped off slowly. Was there any music playing in the background?
they put some late night love with Graham Torrington came on in the background.
And the point of that was to show that you weren't taking
it seriously. It was to embarrass me. Yeah. And then, you know, probably rightly so. You know, I'd not... As my lateness to that meeting had showed, I wasn't taking the correct actions to make sure that I was there on time. It wasn't a priority to me. The only, you know, godsend of it all was that at a time when rucking was still allowed in rugby, and what I mean by rucking is that you could move someone with your feet. So when I took my top off, yes, okay, I didn't look like the athletic specimen that maybe you did, as much as I hate to admit that you did.
Thank you.
You were a wonderful specimen.
No rock marks on me.
Yeah, not anymore. But so I took my top off, and I had literally, and you know, they did it for this reason. They'd obviously agreed to do it so they could just go look at the state of you sort of thing. And I had literally from my top left shoulder across my torso, three enormous stud marks that had been sort of weeping and oozing and all that sort of stuff. And at that point, Joel took a backward glance because, you know, fly halves, you know, not necessarily renowned for putting their body where it hurts. And Wellesley just said, lad, that is why we're going to keep you. I was like, okay, thank God. They said, right, put your top back on. Pull your trousers
up. Fly up.
consider this a warning. This is going to sound very weird. It wasn't anything like that. But just consider this a warning. And, you know, we expect to see some big changes. And that was, you know,
you must have had something. So we've played with players who have been given chances and then they've not had a second chance, something like that, to a meeting. So they must have seen something in you that they knew. It may have been the stud marks, it might have been the way you played the game.
Yeah.
But they must have seen something back then as a young 18, 19-year-old to think, right, he's what the club's made out of. And I suppose that leads on to why you played there so long.
Mm.
And one of the questions, I know we're looking at your stats, and I want to get them in because I've got an apology for you.
Yeah, go on.
So correct me if I'm wrong. I'm going to read some of these out.
Yeah,
so,
go on.
231 games for the Tigers.
Yeah, I think that's right.
33 tries. 34 for Bath, one try. 7 Premiership titles.
Yeah.
2 Hunting Cups.
Yeah.
First tour of England in 98. Mm-hmm. You made your debut in 2001.
Yeah.
71 caps for England,
yeah,
and also a former captain of England as well. 9 tries,
yeah,
3 Lions caps,
yeah,
played in 3 World Cups, and in the 2003 one where you actually went on and won it. Not that you've mentioned it much on these podcast series, you featured every game in that 2003 World Cup,
and in 2007,
and in 2007 as well.
Mm.
Captain England for the first time in 2010. I look at it, and my apology is because when people ask me questions about who are the key players that you played with, like the legends of the game, You never spring to my mind, genuinely. You know, I'm not saying that for a joke. Yeah. I never see you as a legend of the game because I play with you and you're my mate and we've played together. And I always point to the older players. But looking at that CV, that's pretty impressive. There's my apology. I'm never going to say it again.
Well, but that's because we are mates and we came through together, aren't we? So you never reflect on, like, our legends were the guys that were our heroes, like Jono.
I think it's important to point out that if I look around, when I did this, I was looking at other people that I played with who've also gone on to achieve amazing things. And I thought, and it made me stop and reflect, thinking, God, yes, you do look at the older players, but also the people that you're playing with at that time gone on to achieve. So you don't look back. It's only when you finish you look back and go, wow, that was pretty decent.
Yeah.
You must look back now, but after I've just said that to you now, I think that was pretty decent. We're not going to talk about the stuff you've done since, but rugby wise,
I loved my career. I loved it. And I don't consider myself a legend of the game or anything like that. I was really lucky to have an amazing career at a time when there was also a load of other amazing players around. Like, you know, you and me came in at the same time. You know, Jordan then came around, Jordan Murphy came around a year later. You know, throw into that some other younger guys like Ben Kay, Martin Curry.
He'll be pleased you've chucked him in as a younger guy.
He's older than us. But and then you've got tons of other guys that people don't even remember, like Will Johnson, Jono's brother, Jamie Hamilton. Not necessarily younger guys, but huge squad
in
squad
and around
players.
That time. Yeah,
JP Riley. So there's lots of people coming in, and then you forget about all that. You have the proper club legends that were Jono, that were, you know, Cockers, Garth, Graham Rowntree.
But I think there'll be people. This is my point. I think there'll be people who will be listening to this and, not us, but people who will be, when they're talking about the lesser legends, they'll be, your name will be included within those names.
Mm.
And you may not, although you don't include yourself in that now, and it'd be a bit weird if you did call yourself a legend, there will be lots of people out there.
Maybe that's the new nickname.
Yeah.
When I go live somewhere else.
It worked with Mad Dog. What do they call you? Some people call me the legend.
That nickname.
But I think that's the point. People would be describing you as that. And what was it about Leicester? I know you were you're not a Leicester lad, really, were you? Berkshire?
I consider myself a Leicester lad. I was born in Ascot, Berkshire, Bracknell,
And grew up in Leicestershire. But you definitely epitomise what that Leicester squad was about back then. And if you look at the challenges for you, if you think in the back row that was then, it was a pretty decent back row.
Mm.
It was Dean Richards, John Wells and Neil Backy.
Yeah.
So you're an understudy to the best open side in England at the time.
Yeah.
And you stayed there, and then Leicester proceeded then to sign other players as well. They signed Josh Cromfelt, and you still stayed there, still playing, and played at 6, played at 7 when Backy wasn't there, covered to the World Cup. Lots of other players with a different mindset, and they wouldn't be criticised for it, may have considered leaving Leicester to go and be, because you could have walked into most of the Premiership sides as first choice 7, but you didn't. You stayed at Leicester. Why was that?
Do you know what? So for me, the enjoyment of the game comes from playing with individuals that I have an absolute desire to jump in front of a bus for, but put myself in harm's way for. Like, the enjoyment from playing the game came for looking someone in the eye afterwards, knowing that we'd been through some real pain together. And leaving a club like that, and mates, you know, I wasn't sure that I'd be able to I wasn't sure that I'd get the same enjoyment from another club. And I'd grown up at Leicester. It was the only place I ever wanted to play rugby. You know, sat in the stands at 10 and 14. It was the only place I wanted to play rugby. And I got to do it when I was 18. It was crazy. Never expected that to happen. And your career goes on and you have different challenges that come in its way, like players like Backey and Josh Kronfeld and all these incredible legends that, well, I considered legends. And you have to make a decision. You know, are you going to sit back and see that as a challenge? When I say sit back, I say, are you going to, like, so them signing Josh Kronfeld, you know, in my head I was thinking, okay, I'm now like fourth choice, because they also had like Adam Boarding, Peter Shaw, said Martin Curry, Will Johnson, Paul Gustard, who's now head at coach at Quinns,
Eric Miller. England
coach, Eric Miller. I mean, loads of amazing players, you know, so I probably wasn't even third or fourth choice at the time. But for me, for whatever reason, I saw that as, okay, I could leave and go to Sale or Harlequins. I went and met Zinzan Brook, who was coaching Harlequins at the time, another legend, a hero of mine, who offered me a chance to go there. Sale offered me some really good money to go there at the age of, what, 20, 21. But ultimately, I thought, okay, I could take the money and play at a club that's going to achieve probably very little in the next few years, and I'm not going to learn or develop, and will I get the opportunity to play for England still? I just thought, if I stay, I can learn off Josh and Backey, two greatest open sides in the world at that time, and that can have hopefully a big impact on me and fight for my position and in a club that I absolutely love playing for, with mates that, you know, I would have done anything for. So for me, rugby was always that brotherhood. It was a connection for the individuals that I loved, and I think that's the hardest thing when you step out of it.
So let's fast forward to the time then when you did leave Leicester. And is that a shock? Because you've come off the run of a pretty successful period. You had your ups and downs with injuries, largely downs. You know, although you've named those games you've played, you managed to play a lot of games. You've still, if you think about it, if we actually to list your injuries now, how many injuries could you list your injuries you've had?
No, I couldn't list them all. I had about 14 operations, I think. So 14 operations in total,
all the way across and some quite weird ones as well. Not like your usual Gilmore's groin or shoulder reconstruction. Yeah. You had those as well, but other weird ones.
Yeah, well, so Wales always gave me grief for breaking my hand, opening a Christmas present once. That wasn't quite how it happened. I've had all sorts along the way. I mean, the worst were the shoulder reconstructions. I got kicked in the eye, so I lost 30% of the vision in my left eye, which is a bit annoying.
Still 30% down.
Yeah. I mean, thankfully it was my, you know, so I've got, I'm short-sighted anyway, and I have astigmatism in my left eye, and thankfully it was my left eye that got injured again, so my dominant eye is still dominant. And the brain's an amazing thing, the body's an amazing thing, because it learned. So went blind for 48 hours in the left eye.
How was that?
Yeah, do you know what, at the time when it happened, it was brutally painful, and actually it was me charging a ball down, trying to charge a ball down, and my arm got kicked and my thumb went into my own eye.
Thumbed your own eye?
It's classic, isn't it? You know, imagine the amount of abuse I got in the team meetings. So I was at Bath at this time. But instantly, literally, I couldn't see out of my left eye. The doc came on, shining a torch. He was like, close your right eye. I was like, what are you doing? Because I obviously couldn't see anything.
Where have you gone?
where are you? And so I couldn't see anything. But all that I thought of at the time, there was a guy that played called Barry McDermott, who played for Leeds, who had one eye. Do you remember?
I know him well. Big Baz.
And in my head, all I was thinking was, my instant thought was, Barry McDermott played with one eye, so there's absolutely no reason why I cannot continue playing in this game. We're playing Gloucester at the Rec.
And that in itself is just...
And it was one of those, wasn't it? You know, I always wanted to stay on the pitch and never wanted to leave, because you feel like you're letting your mates down. And it was clearly apparent that I couldn't see. So trying to catch the ball became vastly harder.
I think I had that same thing in my eye. I think I was blind in both eyes sometimes, but most of what injuries have you had? Go through just quickly what you can remember.
So I had a hip reconstruction, microfracture they called it, where they dislocate your hip and they take out the cartilage and they chisel it and then acts as a lubricant, and it's trying to replace your hip cartilage essentially. Plates in my ankle, broken foot, broken navicular.
What's the navicular?
It's a bone at the bottom of your foot. Oh yeah, I'm pointing at things. It's a bone bone at the bottom of your foot. So it's like the main loading bone. I actually picked up during the World Cup in 2003. So second game in, I was trying to sprint. I was like, oh, you know when you get like sticky and you're like, I couldn't quite sprint properly. And it sort of wore off. Told the doc, he said, oh, we'll have a look at it. It seems fine. Next game, got worse. Had it scanned, nothing. Anyway, got through the whole World Cup. The next game, when we came back after the final, played, I think it was either Bath or Stade Français, memory's blurry, but someone stamped on my foot and I was out for a year. And I had it turned out I had a stress fracture in the navicula, which is, it was a tiny fracture, but it's the main bone that takes all your weight. So I got through all that World Cup without someone standing on my foot. I mean, how lucky was that? You know, had they done, I would have been like, you know, we spoke to Danny Grukov, yeah. I spoke to Danny last week, and he ended up missing that. I would have missed, you know, one lucky moment like that, I would have missed a World Cup final.
Sliding doors.
Yeah, so anyway, that happened, wrist. Oh, God, mate, I can't remember. Knee, how many knee operations? Actually, it's only recently that I went surfing in the summer that my knee has started to plague me. I'm sorry, I just flopped on you. Just wipe that off. But I jumped up on a surfboard in the sea, like nothing, and all of a sudden my knee blew up.
Don't get me started on knees.
Oh, God,
don't
yeah,
get
sorry.
Me started
yeah.
on knees. Yeah. Would you say, if you look at your injuries, I know you used to get loads of abuse from the lads, like, banter, about you got injured more playing for England. You didn't get injured playing for Leicester, did you? You were fit for the England games. You don't get to choose when you're fit for games. That's just the way it is. But there were times when you were just on this, like you said, you were out for a year, for a long time. Out for a long time. That must have been really frustrating.
Yeah.
That you're out for a long time. Then you come back, and like most injuries, you've got a damaged knee. You come back, and then you pick up something on the other side of your body. Mm. They're dark times. And how did you cope with one being injured? Because if you're out for a long period of time, you train by yourself with the physio, you don't join in that as much banter. And we know that how much you love being part of that, you know, the jovial side, the team side. So that in itself is tough. Then coupled with all the banter, that kind of point about that comes about being injured and only being fit for the England games. How was that?
I hated being injured. I absolutely hated it. I sat in a meeting once with a guy who I really admired and like as a bloke, Pat Howard. And I sat in a meeting where's, it was either him or one of the other guys, might have been Simon Cohen, said something like, mate, you've been injured for, you know, you've been out for a long while now. There's questions, you know, asked around your commitment to the club. You know, so, you know, some people have been comparing you to, and I don't mean this derogatorily to the name I'm going to say it was, let's just say to another player who had been considered as, you know, not being very committed and, you know,
that must be
pulling
like,
out.
Knowing you as I know you, that must have been like red rag.
Well, you can imagine, mate. I just went off the wall at him, and they were like, whoa, okay. I was like, who said it? They obviously didn't throw anyone under them. Yeah. It was him. But yeah, so it was, mate, I never wanted to be injured. I just the manner in which I played the game meant that I picked up more than my fair share of injuries, and it was frustrating. It was the biggest frustration now. And if I look back and anything I'd change, would I change? It would probably be temper the way that I trained, because it's all well and good. You know, in a game you can get injured because at least then you're there to play. But getting injured in training prior to the game is foolish, really. But I just could never see that, because we came through at such a young age when you had to prove a point and everything that you did in every session.
Training was harder than some of the games.
Exactly.
But if you look back on your stats though, 231 for Leicester, add on another 71 for England, there you're at 300, then you've got your line. So these are top class games. So even if you did, I don't think I got injured that much. I wouldn't have played, you know, that many, I would have been there or thereabouts, but that's a lot. You didn't miss that much. At the time, it probably felt like you could have played
maybe. It did feel like loads. And also, a lot of those, you look back on all those, I played the majority of the autumn internationals and summer tours, but in very few Six Nations games. Whatever reason, I was always injured. I suppose you look at it, you've had a long year, you have the build-up, so you have, 12, 15 games up until Christmas. Maybe the body's starting to get weak and tired at that point. So it's always the Six Nations that I seem to miss. I look back on that time now, and injury served me really well in terms of how to cope with stuff, because it gave me a mindset that nothing became a barrier. Everything was
so
just
the resilience piece that we talk about. Yeah. So the injuries is one of those softer skills that you, at the time, you probably don't. You'd prefer not to have to go through it.
Yeah.
But you managed to use that to your advantage.
Yeah, in hindsight, definitely. I hated it at the time. I hated it, and I'm sure all the strength and conditioning staff and physios would tell you that I was a nightmare. Because I just wanted to be back quicker and sooner. But it made me focus really on myself and my body, and, you know, getting away from that immature, unprofessional individual that started my career, you know, learn how to balance it, yes, and that there's an important downtime, but also when you needed to be professional. And it, you know, actually those injuries really focused my mind onto myself, understanding how to get the best out of my body, how to get back quicker. It made me even more determined to get back and playing, because at Leicester you had this big gym area, the new development as it was when we were there. And the top floor was the gym, and there's a big glass window. It looked directly out over the first team playing pitch. So when you weren't playing, you were watching everyone do what you wanted to do. And it was the most infuriating thing in the world. So you would do whatever it took to get back quicker. I remember pushing physios time after time to get me back, probably before I was ready. And I was really lucky. There was a guy called Scott Tyndall who... There were many physios and Mark Geese and all these guys, but Scott in particular, who I really felt had my best interests at heart. And I knew if he said I was ready, I was ready. Whereas, you know, sometimes because I wanted to push and wanted to be back, it'd be easy for a physio or someone to go, okay, get him back in there, and then you can break down quickly, can't you? But all of that stuff's only possible as well if you've got a massive support network. I remember after breaking my foot in 04, after the World Cup in 03, and then being out for a year, and we went to Peebles, you, me, and the entire Leicester Tigers squad. And I went, I was due to be back running. So I'd been out for a year. It was the start of pre-season. I was going to be into the start of the next season. It was going to be great. First running session, it was as if nothing had changed. I literally couldn't run. And I remember kicking off massively in to myself, not to other people. It's like, this shit, you know, just... stormed back into the building. Darren Grucock, who was the strength and conditioning coach at the time, was like, what are you doing? Get back out here, get back out. And my head had gone, you know, when you just have a moment, head had gone. And actually what was amazing was that I had mates, you, Jordan, and a couple of other guys who recognised that I needed support and I was in a low spot. And
did we go out?
And we did, didn't we? So we had a cheeky moment.
The people's six or people's
yeah,
five?
Yeah, people's four.
People's four. I've never been good with numbers.
But so we went out. We had an amazing night, and it was what I needed. I just needed to remember that actually, you know, it's not the end of the world. You'll get back. We'll forget about it for the time being. It's like a realignment, isn't it? It's like
balancing that just before
you go on to balancing that. That I remember having to go in the next morning because we got caught out, didn't we? And having to go in and apologise to Wellesley and accept that the responsibility was mine and that you guys were just trying to look after me. But it was the best moment, like recognising what a supportive group of teammates can do, and having that around you is that is so important to getting through.
I remember calling in, remember getting in reception. We came in at that time, we weren't supposed to be out. We called on our hands and knees.
I remember, didn't reception. I drag you?
You dragged me back.
I dragged you, and you got friction burns. But yeah, the balance.
So I was going to say, the balance of having the physical injuries, then the mental struggles with trying to get back and being injured again. And then you were diagnosed in 2005 with colitis.
Yeah.
So you've got those things. Now, when I say unusual setbacks, how does that cope with one, playing elite sport, one, balancing that with the physical nature, and also you didn't tell anyone about it. You know, even your closest mates, you didn't tell anyone. How did you cope with that? And what made you decide to keep it?
I didn't cope with it at all, really.
What is colitis?
So ulcerative colitis is inflammation of the bowels. It's essentially ulcers of the colon and anything connecting. So, I had never even heard of it when I was diagnosed. And essentially, all of a sudden, started getting loads of stomach pains. I had to go, you know, losing lots of blood whenever I went to the loo. And, you know, for months, I'd sort of not say anything. But it got to a point where literally I couldn't be more than like 2 feet from the loo. So you just had to go. Like, you know, when you look at elderly people and thought, you know, incontinent or can't control, I was like, how can you not control going for a wee or a poo? And very quickly, I understood. You know, I had to carry a change of clothes in the car. I had to try and move. This wasn't the reason I didn't move closer to training because of this. We moved because we wanted to move house. But being closer made life easier. Still didn't mean that I could get to training without.
So who knew about this? Parents,
Annie and my folks initially. Were just Annie initially.
And it wasn't something you could tell the doctor or the clerk.
I did eventually, but I didn't want to because I didn't. You know, everything's intrinsically linked, isn't it? So if the doctor knows and the physios knows, they'll tell the coach. I didn't want the coach to know because I had a number of injuries, as we've spoken about, and I didn't want them to think that was another reason that they weren't going to pick me. So I didn't tell them. That made things obviously significantly worse because I'd then be stressed about getting in on time, worried about having to walk out of a meeting because I needed crap, worried about what could happen during a game, in training, getting to training. You know, literally the mundane walking from the car to the training ground became stressful. Getting in the car and traveling from home to training became stressful because if you needed the loo, it was instant. It wasn't like... you've got minutes and 10 minutes, you'd seconds.
We went to play golf. Remember the golf in Scotland? And none of us knew. Myself, you, Geordie, it was Mitch, I can't remember who else was there. We were driving, I think you were driving, and we were driving towards this golf course, and then all of a sudden, you got quicker and quicker, heading towards this building, then it screeches on the brakes. You get out without any, without speaking to us, get out of the car and run outside. And we just look around in the car going, what the hell is going on? You go out, you come back in a few minutes. I suppose this might have been, a balance of our friendships, that you got back in the car and we gave you a bit of abuse, but no one really asked you what it was, what you did, and you didn't explain what it was, and then we went off and played golf.
Yeah.
Only on reflection looking back, that was probably a time.
That was exactly it, yeah. I mean, it was ongoing for years.
How do we not know? How do we not ask?
I suppose you don't, do you? If what you don't know, you just don't know, so why would you ask?
So do you think it held you back from...
No.
Rugby-wise?
It definitely, there was one year that it definitely hampered me. So remember we had that semi-final against Cardiff at Millennium Stadium and it went to the drop goals. Yeah. I was coming back from a really bad inflammation period then and I got back into it. And I definitely wasn't, you know, right. I probably wasn't physically, mentally right to play, did play. I think probably two or three tries that were conceded in the dying moments of me coming off the bench, probably my fault. We narrowly won that game. So it did impact me. Thankfully, other than that moment, we won that game. But other than that moment, it never really held me back. It did nearly scupper me going on the Lions tour in 05. You know, I ended up having to take enemas, you know, so you had to take essentially tubes that you'd stick up your ass and you'd put a, what do you call it? Not anti-inflammatory, it was like steroid to try and reduce the inflammation. And then obviously you had to have a consent form for that. So
by this stage, you told people about it. So people were aware that of the condition.
Yeah, so when I told the coach also had a very similar issue. And he was like, mate, I totally get it. But yeah, as soon as I spoke about it, so I'd spent probably a year and a half, maybe longer, hiding it. And then as soon as you speak about it, all of a sudden you actually recognize the stress that you put yourself under more by not talking about it made it significantly worse. As soon as I spoke about it, even if it was just with the coach and the strength and conditioning and the physio, so all the medical team knew initially, then I think when I was recovering from that injury that I told you about, broken navicular, it was that year out that probably meant I was taking anti-inflammatories, painkillers, all the supplements, everything. My body was like a medicine cabinet. Throw on top of that, I probably think that they had a large reason to do with why I got ulcerative colitis in the first place. But, it became very difficult. And as soon as you start talking about it, you know, there's obviously a big mental health piece at the minute, isn't it? You know, it's about sharing and talking. It's exactly the same with any illness. I think it's anything in life. The more you talk about it, the easier it is. The less you talk about something, the more stress you put on yourself to deal with it yourself. And no one can deal with these things if you don't know enough information. So actually just talking about it meant that I'd be walking down the street and someone would come up, because it's embarrassing to talk about going to the loo, right? People would just come up and go, Lewis, mate, you've got colitis. Literally in the street, someone I did not know. You know, oh, how is it? How have you coped? How have you done professional sport and coped? It's incredible. I can't even get out of bed. And all of a sudden it meant that I felt like I was giving other people an outlet to talk about it, which was really cool. And, you cope with things, don't you? You figure out how to overcome them, you know? You call it resilience. And we talked about with Rosie Wayne Oil and one of the podcasts about, you know, being weak or not. It's not being resilient or not. It's experiences. You become resilient from putting yourself in uncomfortable situations or being put in uncomfortable situations, getting through it, sometimes getting it wrong, sometimes getting it right. But it all builds. And all the injuries that I went through as a kid, all the mistakes I made, all helped me learn how to overcome this. And it just meant the discipline, the mindset that I had as a sportsman to be able to then go, right, I'm cutting out all the medication, everything, sporting and that I needed for my colitis. And I just focused on diet. And I had the discipline from being a sportsman to be able to be militant with it as well. And like just took everything, stripped everything out of my diet, went back to oily fish and chicken. And then over weeks and months, introduced food gradually, slowly, figured out what it was that caused me issues. You know, ironically, protein shakes were massive irritation. So I had to find a new form of keeping weight on or supplementing that. And, you know, come out the other side. And a year and a half down the line from taking that decision, I was virtually symptom free and have been from that moment. But I was only able to do that because of the injuries and the issues I've been through with.
So we got onto this point. We were talking about resilience and talking about listening to the injuries, everything else. So let's go back to why we were on it about being of a resilient nature when you were leaving Leicester.
Yeah.
So that must have been a tough time. Having to leave a club you played for all those years.
Yeah.
Can you remember what it was like or how it came about?
Well, I remember the phone call. I remember the phone call that brought it to an end, my time at Leicester. Like I said, I never wanted to leave. Yes, contract negotiations could always be drawn out because, you know, agents will try and push for more money, and, you know, mine, and I was probably guilty of that at times. I had a particularly good, I was just being announced England captain, I was playing well, and I got a phone call on the way back from an England training session from Cockers, which, you know, I never got a phone call from Cockers, saying, mate, do you mind coming in for a meeting in the morning? So contract negotiations had been going on for about 3 months. They'd asked me to retire after the World Cup from internationals. You know, I sort of took that as a slight, I wanted to retire after the World Cup, but I felt like they were pushing me into it rather than just saying, you know, would you consider it? Which I was doing. Anyway, so it dragged out and I got a phone call from Cockers coming to the office. So I called my agent straight away. I was like, mate, look, this never happens. Something, it's either going to be really good or really bad. And I went into the meeting the next morning. So my agent rang a couple of clubs. And literally as I walked in the office, Cockers just said, mate, it's bad news. We're not going to renew your contract. I was like, was it 14 years I'd been there at that point, from the age of 14 when we first set foot on a youth team together? Obviously, you'd been through this a couple of years prior to me, but I'd never considered what it would actually feel like, because we're all, you know, stupid humans, aren't we? We have to experience it ourselves to have any empathy. Well, I do anyway. Maybe I'm lumping everyone in the same boat. I remember literally sitting in that room, just me and him, genuinely tears in my eyes. I was like, whoa, that is not what I want or what I expected. Okay, I had an inkling, but I didn't think it was going to be that bad. And all of a sudden, you go from spending your entire life focused on one, well, your last 14 years focused on one goal, one dream, you know, making and working with your mates, making a club the best it could be, playing for your boyhood club, to not having a club. And I remember leaving that room. You know, we'd been discussing stuff with other clubs, obviously, but had no guarantees. And actually a chance conversation with my wife's best mate, Natasha, now Grucock, Danny Grucock's wife, said, well, actually, look, Bath are looking for a seven. Have you spoken to Bath? So after that conversation, we spoke to Bath, and, you know, well, I don't think...
Everyone's available at that point.
Yeah. Well, so actually I didn't want Cockers. I didn't want the decision to impact anything. My time remaining at Leicester, which was, you know, several months. And
still a certain month left the season.
Yeah, several months. I can't remember how many. But also I didn't want them to announce that they weren't renewing my contract, because I felt that maybe clubs wouldn't want to sign me if they thought that Leicester were letting me go.
Like, as England captain.
Yeah. What would the reason be? Why would they let me go? It was like, so actually I told them not to tell anyone what the reason was, and we just announced it that I was going to be leaving. So actually no one knew at the time, and the amount of abuse I got, why would you leave Leicester? I was going for the money, all that sort of shit. It was nothing like that. I was released from my contract.
Keeping that quiet.
Yeah.
When you're hearing all the noise going around you, it must have been tough.
I hated it, and I hated not telling people and the real reason, but part of that was a loyalty to Leicester as well, like a completely unfounded loyalty that wasn't reciprocal in any way, shape or form, other than from the players, you know. So yeah, I mean, I still definitely have bitterness towards the club, rightly or wrongly. It was a good business decision. I can look at it rationally and go, yeah, you know what? I played 16 games for Bath in a year and a half, which is nothing really. I went off to a World Cup. I retired after a year and a half of that happening. So was it a good decision? Yeah, probably saved them some money, didn't it? But does it make it any easier for me? No, because that was my club. And I hate going back there now and having those sort of resentments, feeling those resentments towards it and towards individuals, because I loved spending time there.
And do you think that will, I know we've discussed it, do you think that will fade over time? Do you think time's a good healer? You say the club is not the building, the infrastructure, it's the people and the memories that you created. Yeah. And you've obviously got lots of amazing memories.
Yeah.
And when you see the guys, do you think that will fade, or is it fading?
I think it does a bit, but I think I'll always harbour some sort of bitterness. I just think I will, because I didn't want to leave Leicester. You know, maybe I went about it wrongly in terms of the negotiation. Maybe would I have actually taken a pay cut to stay at Leicester? Yeah, I would have done, actually. But you know, when agents get involved, you know, sometimes everything gets mired, doesn't it? So am I glad I moved? Ultimately, of course, I'm glad I moved, because I got to experience something different. Did I enjoy my rugby at Bath? Not so much. I didn't feel like it had the same professional outlook that Leicester did. I didn't feel that they were as committed. Were there some awesome individuals there that played the game brilliantly? Yeah, there were. And I loved playing with lots of them and learning new things. And I definitely could have done things better in my approach to my time at Bath. I felt that I came in with this big Leicester Tigers sort of background of Premiership titles and European titles, and thought I could change everything and put Bath on the straight and narrow. And, well, you know, I was completely naive. Yes, I can help change things, but you know, you have to do it slowly and over time. And I enjoyed my time at Bath, and I live there now. I didn't enjoy the rugby as much because it wasn't Leicester, and I love playing at Leicester with my mates, and it was as simple as that. And the hardest thing still now is the fact that I moved to Bath means that I live, you know, 4 hours away from my mates, you, Jordan, Mitch, other guys that I now see on such an infrequent basis. It's a genuine sadness. But my boys, my own family, they love it there. They're thriving, and that's home now. So, you know, decisions like that happen, and you come around and you have to deal with it, don't you?
Yeah, good. Tough.
Good.
Yeah, good.
I'm thinking about something else. So let me move on to this.
I wasn't expecting to answer it so openly and honestly. I thought I was going to have to try and get that out of you. So it was actually taking me by surprise. But I know it's tough. It's tough to talk about.
Yeah.
I think by talking about it, it probably helps ease it a little bit.
Yeah.
Show your side of what happened. Because a lot of people won't be aware of that, and they'll believe what they read or what they make up their own perceptions. Let's talk. I know we've been talking a long time, and I want there's a few other bits which I want to get in because there's so much we could talk about. We haven't talked about you as captain. Captain in England.
Yeah.
And also there's that infamous red card as well, which will come and feature at some point. So captain in England, what? I've never played with you. You've never been my captain.
Yeah.
And I'd struggle. Like before, when I wouldn't never think of you as, if I'd put down a legend, I wouldn't think of you because I know you.
Do you think I would have made a good captain? Do you think, in your time playing with me, do you think I would have made a good captain? That's not a loaded question. I'd love to know the answer.
I think you were a leader anyway. I think you were a leader, not by name. So you did stuff. You were a do as I do, not as I say type person, I think. That's what my impression of you. But I think I might have struggled with you as captain because if we look at before the match, we used to play keepy-ups with the ball and mess around. You've got the ABC boys and Garfield were trying to kill people slamming the door shut. Yeah. And we were laughing and joking. And then to see you lead that, I've never been in a changing where you've done that. How did you find that? Was it difficult? And people who know you as well, how do they take it?
Yeah, well, mate, I was nervous about doing it. I've never been a natural captain or leader, I don't think. As you said, I've led by example. I've just led through actions. And then you sort of find the leadership qualities, don't you? You find an area of the game or something that you naturally lead on. For me, it was defence because the manner in which I played the game. I loved that side of it. And I had leadership roles with England and Leicester around defence. But I never saw myself as a natural captain, because I wasn't a big thinker of the game. I just really loved playing. I wanted to be out there and smashing stuff. I didn't think, well, you know, if I smash that, then that might mean that, you know, something else is... I wasn't like a Jordan Murphy or a Pat Howard or a whoever, you know, a thinker of the game. So when I was asked, Jono asked me, so Steve Borthwick was the then England captain, like the polar opposite of me, so all detail, so detailed with his approach, you know, he was an amazing captain. Jono said, look, Borthers is injured. If he doesn't come through, you're going to be captain. And I just remember being super nervous. I remember almost thinking, actually, I'm not going to do it. I don't want to do it because I don't want to put my family in the spotlight. I don't know if I can make all the right decisions. I don't know if I've got the qualities to be a good captain. And I spoke to Jono about it. He actually came around. He called me on the day off and I was on the trampoline with the kids and I ignored the phone call because I didn't want to answer it. Then I saw Molly, his daughter, coming through the house in the garden because he only lived 40 minutes up the road from me when I was at Leicester. And I was thinking, oh, balls, I probably should have answered the phone call. and then he came like striding up the garden and we were stood weirdly, awkwardly next to the trampoline and watching the kids mess around. And he was like, so, you all right?
Please tell me you didn't actually take your top off.
Yeah. No, it wasn't that moment.
Not
again.
That
would have been really awkward. Guys, let's get a naked trampoline. No, he just literally turned around, looked at me and went, so do you want to be captain? I was like,
hang on a minute.
How do you answer that?
Hang on a minute. You're being asked to captain your country of the sport that you love doing.
Yeah.
And the way it's just like casually, fancy it.
But it's awkward. You know what you're like with it, mate. You know what it's like with, you know, having a conversation with John about something serious like that. It's like, I knew what he was there for. He knew why he was there.
Did you try and make it awkward for him?
No. I was awkward than that. I didn't even know the answer that I was going to give at that point.
But knowing you, as I do, you'd have been emotional. Was there a little tear?
When I was with Jono, I felt very proud. Like, Jono, I consider the country's greatest ever leader, would deem me in any way, shape or form, you know, worthy of captaining the country. Then yes, it was that moment was incredible. And then to be able to tell my dad, I always find it hard talking about my dad these days. I find it hard talking about Dad because he has Alzheimer's these days, and so you know doesn't feel like my dad anymore. But
at the time when you told your dad, I mean, the moment for you, the pride that you would have felt in your family, yeah, and your dad, Ken Basil,
yeah. Ken Basil.
He must have been amazing for him and your mum.
Yeah. So for Ken, for those that don't know, Ken Basil was the name, as a young man, was my agent. It was the pseudonym he took. His name is actually Lewis Moody. So it was all very confusing. So he thought, right, we'll have a Ken Basil, which was his dad's name, Ken Moody. And anyway, so that obviously got found out by the players, and that was then mercilessly taking the piss out of.
When you're speaking to him, that must have been special.
Yeah, mate, it was really cool. Like, to be able to tell my dad, who I'm an only child, dad came from really humble beginnings, you know, lived in a house in Eton, you know, two up, two down, grandparents lived on the top floor, he lived on the bottom floor with his brother, and you know, all that sort of stuff, born during the Blitz. He did everything he did, you know, within reason, so that I could have the opportunities I had, like, so work to put me through private school, because he didn't have that opportunity, and he felt that he would have succeeded more in life if he had had that chance, you know. Albeit I necessarily didn't succeed at the academic side of my public school, but the springboard.
You've got a doctorate, haven't you?
Yeah, well, I do.
You'd
yeah,
be really proud.
Thoroughly well
really
earned, proud. Like your World Cup medal from 2019. Really well deserved. To be able to call him after that moment with Jono and go, mate, look, you know, I know you've pumped a lot of money into me and investment over the years, and look, I hope I can, you know, reward that investment by telling you I'm now going to be England captain in the next game against France away. And mate, it was really cool. It was a really cool moment to be able to have with your dad, you know. As a boy, your dad's your dad, isn't he, right? Is your hero. So, it was cool. Was I a good captain? Mate, I tried to be as good a captain as I could be. Did I get everything right? Definitely not. Got lots of things wrong. I approached it in a manner which was, right, I need to make sure everyone's happy, right? So if everyone's happy, we'll all get it right. So I remember my first tour to Australia, I had all the, like, Ben Youngs, Courtney Laws, Dylan Hartley, loads of young quality players, and I literally worked with every department making sure everything was all right. Come the game, you know, we're all pushing for a first series win in Australia ever for England, and we're odds on to do that. First game we lose, I miss 7 tackles, which is completely unheard of, you know. If I missed 2 tackles, 1 tackle in a game, that was a bad day for me. And so very quickly I recognised that actually I was crap at delegating, so I was trying to do everything, make sure everyone was all right. Totally forgot that what I was good at was just doing what I did, playing and focusing on that. And Jono's point to me when I was captain, I said, mate, would you give me any advice? He said, just be yourself. The reason we've asked you to be captain is be yourself. Wayne said it in his podcast, you know. Leaders, you're not just a leader because you're given the captaincy. You're a leader because you're always leading. You know, you're in that position. So, mate, there are tons of things I got wrong. You know, we then went to the World Cup in 2011. That I have to admit, that tour in 2010, that second game, once I realised delegation, just focus on me, actually let everyone take responsibility for their own areas and just work on the areas that I can do to make me better, and then work with our leadership players.
You weren't captain when you had the red card at Twickenham?
No, that was 2006. Or 2005.
So you got sent off at Twickenham, then became England captain afterwards.
Yeah.
That's pretty special as well.
Yeah, well, like I said, you learn a lot during your career, don't you? Like, I learned when I was an immature 18-year-old.
What did you learn from that? Some of the questions we got from social media around, what did Lewis, can he talk us about the red card incident, especially with his teammate, and our teammate, and how was training the next day? What did you learn?
Mate, what I learned from that was that a lot of people went, oh, mate, you've got rage issues. You clearly got anger management issues. And I was like, piss off. I haven't got anger management issues.
It smacked him in the
What's
face.
Wrong with you? Yeah. To which point I suddenly realised that, okay, maybe there was something. But do you know what it made me recognise? Like, so reflection is really good, isn't it? Like, so reflecting. So it forced me to think about it. And what I realised was that all the injuries I had, like, that kept building up over time prior to that point, and then I'd just come off the back of that long one in 2003. My frustrations from being injured manifested in violent acts when I returned, but I didn't realise until this. My sending off against Samoa wasn't the blatant act of violence. Well, it was, but it wasn't my intention. My intention was to separate Mark Kuwaito and Alex Tuilagi from having a fight. Then Alex punched Kuwaito in the face and I had a red mist moment. And I'm very protective like an individual, I'm very protective, and on the pitch, and that's why I played the way I did. I was protective of everyone. I wanted to get the ball back for my teammates, make sure I could do everything I could to do that. And then, so, you know, my reaction wasn't necessarily, I say it's one of protection, but I think I threw about 30 punches. So maybe, you know, slightly over-egged it, and very quickly recognised that off the back of that and people saying you've got issues, that I needed to maybe address it. And I did. So I sat down with a sports psychologist. I always thought a sports psychologist is a sign of weakness because I can't deal with my own mental weakness or my own problems, can't deal with my own issues. I need someone else to help me. But it's not, is it? It's just another way of training your brain, like you train your muscles. And as soon as I did that, it was brilliant. He gave me a couple of distraction keys. So in any game, when people would try and target me, rile me, my distraction would be look at the ref straight away. So all I had to think was,
well,
to
see if he's looking at you, see if you can get away with it.
can I get away with it?
Good teaching.
Yeah, no, the distraction, it was just distraction. It was the art of distraction. It was look at the ref, because that will distract you long enough to take you out of the moment. And then I never had a yellow card or a red card after that.
So I want to ask you, I've asked some people to give me these three words. We did this test before. If I asked you to give me three words that you think describe you.
Yeah.
Remember we did this at your house and I gave the three words?
Oh my God, yeah.
Wait, we won't talk about me, because that makes you start laughing, the three words I give.
Yeah.
But the three words that you would give, that you would describe you.
Yeah.
What would they be? Just before you answer.
Oh, you know, positive or negative?
You know, any three words you think would describe you, because I've asked some people to give me some words, and I want to see how they, reality versus perception.
Yeah, okay. I would like to think loyal, humble, and committed, but I also think there will be...
No. What do you think? Give me the three words that you think.
I don't think I can summarise it in three words, because I think...
Well, let's go what you've just said then. Loyal, humble, and committed.
Okay.
Okay? Yeah. They're good words.
Yeah.
Okay? Not laid back, happy-go-lucky. Yeah.
Okay, I'm dreading this.
So the people I asked, yeah. Your good wife, Annie.
Yeah.
I asked your son, Dylan. I asked
Did
Jono.
You really?
I did. I asked Jono.
You are such a conniving little...
I asked Jono. So let me just write down. What were the words that you said?
Loyal, humble, and committed.
Okay, let's go. So Annie put gentle, loyal, and childlike.
Yeah, that's fair enough.
I also asked Lisa, actually.
Oh, yeah. Lisa Lloyd, your wife.
Yeah. And she put fun, excitable, and kind.
Brilliant.
There's a theme.
Very little around detail.
I asked Dills, the D unit, Big Dylan, your son. He put, what do you think you put?
Oh, God. Well, maybe he said strict, fun, and I don't know.
Fun, you're right.
Yeah.
Loving, which is awesome.
That is awesome.
And sporty.
Oh.
How good is that?
That's the best.
They're all good words. And then... Yeah. Just to finish on Jono's.
You're trying to make me cry again.
just to finish on Jono's. I think he got the wrong end of the stick, because I put, give me three words to describe Moody.
He would have put crazy, idiot.
I'm not even sure what I can say, but he put complete ball end. But then he came back and said, actually, I'm not too sure if that's two words or not. But then he came back and said, he's just a genuinely nice bloke. Nothing about your sport.
Yeah.
Nothing about your traits as a leader. Just you as a person, which I think is awesome. You know, you talk about, you think the country's, you said, in your words, the country's best sporting leader describes you as just a genuinely good bloke.
Mm.
I think that's pretty awesome. And the other words are pretty cool as well.
That's really cool. Well, from both those individuals, I think, you know, that's probably why, you know, when you get the opportunity to be captain, you know, you need other qualities in there, and you have to work at things. But, you know, you do those different pieces on, I can't remember what you call it now. What do you call this? Psychometric tests profile, and stuff. Yeah. You know,
so you come out as fun. The words that come out from you, from everyone. And if I was to pick three, I look at those and I think, like, fun, excitable. You know, I just don't see it. No, I'm joking. I'm joking. I see that. I can see why people. Yeah. And I wonder if people who don't know you would see that. People who don't know you and watch you play rugby might have a different perspective of you, because they see how physical you are on the pitch. But the reality is, like Danny Grucott, you talked about, there's on the pitch, then there's who you are when you're not on the pitch.
You have to have that, right? You have to have that. Like, I couldn't have played the game as Mad Dog Lewis Moody. I could play the game as Mad Dog Lewis Moody. I couldn't live my life as a dad as Mad Dog Lewis Moody. Like, chasing the kids, although I do chase them around the garden sometimes, playing rugby. You know, you have to have an on and off switch, but also I think you need split personalities. But, mate, do you know what? That is a really nice thing and way to do it. I think, you know, I remember when we sat down and did that three questions with you.
And It's not about me. I don't want to talk about me, Lewis.
But we did it just sat over, sat over a table.
This day. Still haunted this day. anyway, moving on quickly. That's sure, for another time.
Sure.
As we do at all these podcasts, it's been great. I have got so many more things here to talk about.
Do you think now, like at the end of every podcast I get through, I'm like, oh man, I've not covered half the stuff I wanted to cover. Do you feel like that?
I feel like we've got through lots of stuff, but there's so much stuff that we haven't even covered the stuff you've done since retirement.
Yeah.
There's a lots there, you know, with the Lewis Moody Foundation. All the stuff that you do, the challenges, the treks, the North Pole. We haven't done any of that stuff.
Well, maybe there's another sit down.
There is another sit down. But again, as we finish all of ours, we always ask our guests the piece of advice they've got, the best piece of advice that they've received.
Oh my God.
If you think of one piece.
I can't think of anything, mate. You're like, I'm not detailed, I'm fun and exciting and humble, just a good guy. I don't know about advice.
Some great coaches, some great captains.
Captain, so there's one piece of advice that stuck with me. I don't know whether it's the best piece of advice, but at the time it was really poignant, good piece of advice. Was Bob Dwyer, who is World Cup winning Australian coach in 91, came and coached us at Leicester in 96, 97, said, you know, good players have good games and bad games, great players have good games and great games. And it's not a particularly poignant message or anything like that, but it just made me focus on me as an individual and the fact that actually, you're right, we're all normal and we all go out to have the best game we can possibly do relating specifically to rugby. And it's actually okay sometimes if we don't get it right, because even the best players don't get it right, but it's what your target goals are that are really important. If your target goal is making the first team, then you're probably not going to play for England, you know. If your goal is playing for the Lions, like, or England, like mine was as a kid, then getting to Leicester is amazing, but then you want to get the next hurdle and the next hurdle. And I suppose it was just that recognition of, like, you know, where do you set your targets and what are your aspirations as an individual? But also, it's okay to get it wrong sometimes because you can't always be perfect.
Good advice. As I say, we've got so much more stuff we can talk about, so we'll definitely feed that in future episodes.
Are you going to do the outro? Are you going to wrap this up?
No, I think I'm going to leave that to you to do.
Come on, I want to see you have a go at it. You have a go at it. You are the detail. I'm not detail. I'm fine. I've worked around my notes here. I've never seen so many notes come into it.
I've only gone through half of them. It took me ages to do these.
I was waiting for like a spreadsheet. Or like, what?
I've got a PowerPoint.
But anyway, so we've come to the end, and do you know what? It was awesome being interviewed by you, mate, and chatting about stuff that I didn't even hadn't crossed my mind in a long time. And you know, sometimes that stuff is great to reflect on and talk about and be open about. But we've got a wicked guest coming up on the next episode, Rav Wilding, who will delve into many more questions about. So if anyone's got any interesting feedback on this one, listening to me talk, then please send it over to our social media, Lewis Moody 7, Leon Lloyd 13, or Instagram. What are you on Instagram?
No, not yet.
No, just no, not yet. Not on Instagram yet.
I don't think it's going to work. I don't think it's going to take off. Instagram's not going to take
just
off.
Just emails. Get me on email.
Fax me. Send me a fax.
Also, if anyone wants to understand a little bit more about what Leon does now, he works for Switch the Play, so go and check out switchtheplay.com. As Leon mentioned, I'm off to the South Pole in January for the Lewis Moody Foundation, which supports brain tumours, so check out lewismoodyfoundation.org to learn more there. And if you want to engage and if you want to get involved in a challenge, then please drop us a line because we'd love to get you involved. And of course, don't forget to rate, review and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts, Apple, Spotify. And as always, After Whistle is brought to you by Audioboom.